I want to know what brought you to the area, because Peter touched on it. He said that you decided when you got to this location that was run down that you said this is the place. Peter, what made you think that?
Well, it is a wilderness place, and it had some infrastructure. It had water, power and phone, and to have water, power and phone in the middle of a national park is quite a rare thing, I think. And we wanted to run retreats. We were going to do them in tents in the bush, but having a place here means people can get here easily. The bus used to run past the door, and they can stay in relative comfort, and people with all sorts of abilities can experience the wilderness. So what we're providing is a place where they can experience the wilderness and explore the desert spirituality.
And that was 2005 that you arrived.
Yeah, I bought it in February 2005, and we moved in September 2005 and have lived here ever since. We were trying to juggle work in Perth and Peter's place at 2J and this place, and we couldn't be in three places at once.
What did it look like when you got here, and what is here today that has changed?
Well, Peter's lined everything up east-west to be environmentally sound so that it gets the best solar radiation.
The buildings.
Yes, and we've removed tons and tons of rubbish and put that into landfill and done a lot of revegetation. 12,000 plants, and we've tried to help restore the place to its natural environment, because it's been used as a place where pipeline has been recycled and there's lots of rubbish around. Still a fair amount of rubbish. I call it rubbish. Peter calls it his storage area.
The house itself is a train carriage.
That's right. We live in a railway carriage, yes.
That's beautiful. And did you need to restore it when you got here? Or
no,
was it
we haven't done anything.
Good?
Yes. Oh, we put some hot water in the sink. We didn't have hot water in the sink. And my daughter says to me, Mum, a shower and a toilet and a trough do not make a bathroom, no matter how close they are.
But it is a unique setup, so that we've got the railway carriages, of course, because of the railhead that was here until 71. And then the garden itself is all centred around one beautiful tree, which you say flowers in August, does it?
Yes, I tell everybody who's about to get married, it flowers in the first week of August, and the beautiful pink almond blossom just floats down like confetti. It makes a beautiful environment. And, yes, the whole cloister area is centred around that, and we will have other trees here in due course as well.
And to describe it for the rest of our listeners who won't have seen this place, the east-west buildings that Peter has set up here are dongas. So
that's
where
right.
Did they come from?
Well, most of our dongas came from Yellowdine Roadhouse. When the lease was up, we bought the dongas from the people who owned them and gradually moved them here and set them up so that we could have accommodation for people to come. Very basic accommodation. We're not offering any three-star accommodation, only 5 million-star accommodation.
Where did your interest in the history of this area begin for you?
Well, when we started to see the artefacts lying around and realising that there had been a huge history here before us, that there must have been some very interesting things going on, and we Googled it and looked up that there was a conservation plan being done by Rich at Curtin Uni, and got the guy who'd done the conservation plan showed me his draft and talked to National Trust and found out some of the research that had been done about the area, and realised it's a rich history of infrastructure corridors that have been running through here since 1860s. But before that, it was used as an Indigenous pathway between Norseman and Mount Jackson as well.
There's a rumour and a story about the old hotel that used to be here before, obviously, the railway carriages. Do you know much about that hotel on Kararawi Rock?
Yeah, well, we found in the mines department in Southern Cross the plans where it was sold as a business district number 9 in the location of Kwadanoolijan in 1892. So that was in the gold rush days. Obviously, people travelling along Hunt's Track thought they might need a watering hole, and a hotel was built to get money from the passing trade and provide overnight accommodation.
It's got a colourful history, this hotel.
Yes, it does.
I understand there was a bit of a ruckus.
There have been a few ruckuses, apparently. One of the ruckuses was when it was burnt down when the Gold Coach was here and rebuilt by the person who had the licence, but sold by the owner of the property and not to the licensee. So the licensee removed the property and put it in his shanty. And we see that in the newspaper reports that he was in the Supreme Court being charged with causing injury to a building. And then we see advertisements in the paper saying it was then being run by a Mrs. Kinder, who advertised herself as a widow of good repute. And she said that she was offering accommodation equal to any metropolitan hotel, where I'm quite assured from the police report that it was matchbox and hessian and corrugated iron.
In those days, maybe that was a good setup. And what happened to her?
Well, Mrs. Kinder, the widow of good repute, was also reported in the Coolgardie newspaper as being the subject of a pistol fight between two men who both claimed to be her husband. And the magistrates reported as saying, tell me which one of you is her husband because I want to send her home with you. And Mr. Kinder said, I'm her husband and I will take her back, but if she doesn't want to come, I'll put her into service. Well, you can imagine what service meant on the goldfields in those days. So the poor widow of good repute would not have had such good repute after that.
My guest is Anna Killigrew, who's the host today. We're at Kararawalli, about 160 k's out of Kalgoorlie if you're heading back to Perth. This place used to feature a post office as well, I believe, Anna. What do you know about the post office?
Well, a post office collected mail for people who worked along the railway line and the pipeline and the woodcutters. And it was here from the time this was a railhead, which was this time 115 years ago. And it had a postmaster. And it also is featured in Wise's post office directory, which there are copies of in the library in Perth. And it showed the people who lived here their names to collect for their mail, and mostly there were Irish people. It's quite a huge number of names on that post office directory of Irish people, probably came across from the Victorian goldfields.
And they would have been as well the part of the community that up and left overnight, as Peter says, in about 1970 when the railhead closed. But what happened to the old cottages and the settlement that they would have lived in?
Well, apparently the cultural heritage people say that there were up to 50 people living here at any one time from the signs of different buildings around and the different jobs that were performed. And the buildings have all been bulldozed into the bush, except the one that was here that the Jabaris lived in before us, which was stolen. But I'm sure you'll ask Mrs. Jabari about that one. So the cottages were bulldozed into the bush so that National Trust and people who were interested in cultural heritage couldn't potter around here. I guess it was the Wild West back then.
A water reserve as well, that's one thing that you've taken me out to this morning, that you've been a part of the reason it's still here. The restoration, when did you decide that you were going to be the person to restore that water reserve, and what efforts have you put in?
Well, I'd have to say I decided I was going to be the person to do it when I couldn't find anybody else to do it.
That's often the way.
I tried very hard to get somebody else to do it, anybody but me. But we ended up doing the actual digging out of 300 cubic metres of rubble and silt to clear the reservoir tank so that it would hold water again and not be salty and not be full of yabbies.
Mm. And you had a bit of trouble finding the original well.
Yes, the well was completely covered up in silt, and I was looking through the library and found an old book done by the water authority of the day recording the different water assets along the pipeline, and I saw a photo of the reservoir wall, and I thought that this was our reservoir wall, so I worked out from that photo where the well was and got a guy to come along and dig, and he said, there's nothing there. No, you won't find anything. And I had a group in, so I went away. He came running back from digging. He says, the digger keeps going down. It keeps going down. I said, because there's a well there.
And what does it look like today compared to what it would have originally looked like and have been used for, this water reserve?
Well, it would have originally been a beautiful soak off a rock for the Indigenous people to come and dig a little hole and get some water out as they were passing by. And then when Hunt came along with his crew and used that soak for a while, then he sunk a well in it. So it's a 12-metre well, 12 metres deep, and a stone well in the middle of the Indigenous soak. And then they dug five other wells around the rock trying to find water and couldn't, so they put a harvest wall around it and dug a huge tank that holds 7 million litres of water. So it looks a lot different to how it would have looked before European colonisers came along trying to eke some resource from the land to get over to the gold at Coolgardie and Kalgoorlie.
In your research, has anyone of interest been a part of the community that used to live here when it thrived that's stuck out to you?
I don't understand.
Any characters?
There's a fair few characters. I think everybody who lives out here seems to turn into a character. One of the Indigenous fellows reckons Kararawalli means two madmen, and I said, well, it's still two madmen.
Where does the name Kararawalli come from?
Well, we don't know. It's an Indigenous word, and I think Kurara is the name of the local wattle, and Wallion was the name of an Indigenous group of this area, so it could be some combination of those words.
What do you know about the two lonely graves?
Well, in In 1896, at this time of the year, a year after the railway reached here, the station master's wife had a baby, and the baby only lived 3 or 4 hours and died. And was it, all that the report says that the baby was buried on the railway line. But it must have caused a lot of problem and pain and anguish in that family, because the railway records say that that station master was sacked 2 years later. So maybe he turned to drink in his anguish, you don't know. But it would have been very lonely living out here and trying to give birth to a child that it was a difficult birth and died. Mm. The other lonely grave was a fellow from Victorian Goldfields, an Irish fellow who... Skiffing, I think his name was, who was a labourer with the woodcutters, and he went out from here with them and wandered off from the group and got lost. And so an Indigenous tracker tracked him with the police for 4 days, and they followed him as he gradually got weaker and finally found him dead, and they buried him where he lay. So they're the two lonely graves out here.
Is it eerie being out here?
No, I don't find it eerie, although a lot of people do. If I leave people here and go away for a few days, they say, oh, we're really scared when you weren't there. We'd shut the doors.
Do you go wandering off into the bush? And
yes, I love going to the bush. I mean, we run a retreat centre for people to experience the bush, so I go bush myself every week for at least 24 hours. Peter and I, our best plan is to throw the swag in and go off to the bush and explore the area. We want to know the 30-kilometre radius around here really well.
What do the people who come here for a retreat get out of being in this place, and how much of the history do they have to do with when they come here?
Most people don't notice much of the history at first. It takes a while for them to see artifacts and then ask questions. What they come for is a bit of a wilderness. They want to get away from their city life. They want to be able to drop all the pretense and the charade of life and be who they really are and sit around that campfire and think about that and go for walks out there in the bush and let the silence of the bush allow them to be the people that they are and to deal with the issues in their lives as they are. It's been life-changing for so many people to come out here.
And you and Peter, obviously, as well.
Yes, we love it, and we love each other's company. Imagine being here 24/7 with Pete, huh?
So you would like to know the 30K radius around here of bush really well. What else about the history do you want to get to know?
We are really still very interested in the Indigenous history of this area, because when we had an archaeologist here, they said that they couldn't see any signs of it. But I know that there are Indigenous artefact sites here and natural feature sites, and that the local people do know the story of the area. So we want to be able to work with them to be able to piece it together a bit better.
Anna Killigrew, again, thank you very much for having us today. And I might bring you back a bit later on in the program. We've got lots to talk about.
Thanks, Nat.